which is 084157, United Airlines versus the Airline Pilots Association. Mr. Abram.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. Excuse me. In United Airlines versus Machinists, about 9 years ago, this court held that a district court abused its discretion by not issuing an injunction against a continuing job action to which the union in that case had made an insufficient and ineffectual response. In the present case, Your Honors, the district court abused its discretion, her discretion, by issuing an injunction against an alleged job, sick out and job action that ended before the hearings even began, and that if it took place, the union had disavowed and successfully issued instructions to end.
Now, Mr. Abram, ALPA did not address the significance of the public interest at stake weighed against the likelihood of success on the merits or the harm to United if the injunction is denied versus the harm to the pilots if it is granted. Even if we assume that United has a, let's say, relatively small likelihood of success on the merits, why not grant an injunction that simply requires the pilots to do only what they are already contractually obliged to do? In other words, there is no real harm to the defendants in issuing the preliminary injunction. But the consequences to United and the public could be quite large if job actions continue.
If there were, that could be a large consequence, but of course I'll answer your question in a minute, but the job actions that were alleged had ended. And the answer to your question, Your Honor, is really given by Section 7 of the Norris LaGuardia Act. That's a jurisdictional requirement, 29 U.S.C. 107, which trumps the balancing of the factors considerations because it is jurisdictional and it applies to a preliminary injunction as well as permanent injunction. It applies to all injunctions being sought against labor unions. And if the balancing that is to occur initially, as this court has held, is the balancing between the purposes of the Railway Labor Act and the purposes of the Norris LaGuardia Act. The Railway Labor Act purpose is to protect commerce through collective bargaining and protect the rights of labor through collective bargaining. And the purpose of the Norris LaGuardia Act is it expresses, as the Supreme Court has said, a basic policy against the injunction of activities of labor unions. This court has held that the proper balance between those factors is, as the Supreme Court has also held, to be determined on the basis of the following question in a Section 2 first case, Your Honors, and that is, if there are other effective means to bring about a party's compliance with its duties under Section 2 first, an injunction should not issue.
But now, that's true. That sounds like a factual question to me. I guess one of my concerns about your position is the district court, in this very thorough 85-page opinion, finds that there are no other effective means. Because contrary to what you've been saying, she finds that there really hasn't been, up until the point that the standstill agreement was entered into, which was after the case was filed, there hadn't been a cessation of the unlawful actions by ALPA and its members, and that court action was therefore necessary.
That is at most a mixed question of fact and law, and I think it's an application of the question is the application of a legal standard, Your Honor.
But once we get facts in there, don't we owe some deference to the district court's careful findings of fact?
This court absolutely owes considerable deference, but of course the court had to establish, there had to be proof by clear proof of the union's responsibility. As of July 27th, which was three days before the lawsuit was filed, was the last day of any cancellation that the company complained about in respect to the alleged sick out. That was before the lawsuit was filed. With respect to the alleged slowdown,
but look at the tiny time frame you're looking at.
Well, let me go beyond that. That's right.
For all she knew, you know, in another few days there would have been another round of emails on one of these websites or further action.
This case was heard in late August and through September, argued in October, and decided in November. Mm-hmm. When we opened the case in late August, we pointed out at that time that the alleged sick out had ended in July. We pointed out that the company had no evidence and was presenting no evidence of any continued alleged slowdown activities, which were different from the sick out, the
right.
delays from any period after early August. The company admitted in court, outside of court, that its operations had become normal, and in fact it had a very strong finish to the summer. It rescinded its sick leave letter to the pilots in early September, all of this before the hearing was completed. So this was a case where time marched on, and yes, there was a short time between July 27th and the filing of the case. The filing of the case was the first time that United Airlines had said to ALPA that you are engaging in an unlawful slowdown with respect to all of these delays. They had not said you're engaging in unlawful activity up until that time. So that was the first time that ALPA responded with a statement to the pilots and the MEC, with a statement to the pilots about the alleged slowdown. So when it did that, whether it took action before the lawsuit, after the lawsuit, during the lawsuit, the question is, did it take actions that in the court's view, were successful? And the answer to that was yes.
But you still haven't answered Judge Rovner's first question. What, in fact, putting utterly to one side the Norris LaGuardia Act and everything else, is the harm to you of having an injunction that says do all of the things that you're standing here and telling me that you're
right.
doing anyway?
It's asking me to put aside the Norris LaGuardia Act is like taking Hamlet out of the play, but
That's
I would
all
nonetheless...
Right. We're taking Hamlet out of the play.
We'll take it out for a minute, but if an injunction issues and is maintained, the company has, and this is why Norris LaGuardia Act exists, the company has the right to go to court for contempt. If they don't like what they're seeing, they can go for contempt. So the union and its members are exposed to sanctions for contempt if the company doesn't like what they're seeing. And what have they been talking about here in their injunction is normal operations, meaning, in their view, going back to 2006, even though the environment has changed, they admit the environment has changed, there's been new training programs, but nonetheless, in their view, you go back to 2006. So there's a risk of contempt.
Well, normal operations could mean the outside market, but could also mean, you know, not flying to the contract and not having sick outs and not having...
Correct. It can mean that.
You know, the maintenance issues.
Correct. It can mean all of that, but the question is, how do you measure that? And the company has measured it primarily by operating statistics. So the risk is, just very simply, that why does Norris LaGuardia say to keep the courts out of injunctions unless necessary? Because it puts the union in the position of being subject to a contempt sanction, empowers the company in ways that it should not be empowered unless there is an ongoing need. And that is exactly what there was not in this case. There was no ongoing need. The union had responded, the operation had resumed what the company regarded as its normal operating parameters, the alleged sick out was over. And the union committed itself repeatedly in court, including testimony under oath, that it would maintain that position. It would continue, whether there's an injunction or not, to instruct the pilots not to engage in actions that could disrupt the operation, not to take improper sick leave, and so forth.
Well, the district court wasn't required to accept that representation, and particularly in light of the history here, it seems to me that the court was more than entitled to take into account the course of conduct between the parties in deciding whether or not this injunction was necessary under the statute.
That would be true, Your Honor, and I respect the point, but it would be true in a case, again, where you took Norris LaGuardia out of the picture. Because Norris LaGuardia teaches, as this court has held, that if there are other means available to assure compliance or to provide compliance, then an injunction is not necessary. And in this case, the union was complying with Section 2 first. The pilots were complying with Section 2 first. Yes, you can go back and the court found, we don't accept the findings, but the court found, and we're not trying to argue that right now, that there was a job action in the court's view. But if the purpose of the Railway Labor Act and Norris LaGuardia Act is to provide for voluntary adjustment, if the union voluntarily, as the company admits it did, there was voluntary cessation in the company's view, if the union voluntarily commences, even if it hadn't been commencing, commences compliance with the law, that should be sufficient. That means that the courts are not required to be part of this process, which is what, again, the Norris LaGuardia Act says, unless an injunction is the only means available to assure compliance with a party's obligations. And in this case, it wasn't the only means. The union was complying, the pilots were complying.
Now, there's both a backward-looking and a forward-looking aspect to this here, in that we have historical actions up until the day of the injunction that the union had engaged in, and then we have the district court's obligation to predict the future, and the district court takes into account the voluntary cessation notion that just because you've stopped, we shouldn't have some pattern where you stop, the injunction's lifted, you start again, then you stop again, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And the judge thinks that looking at this standard, the only practical effective means, which was the standard that you argued for, of enforcing the RLA, would be to just fix these obligations in place. You voluntarily, as I recall, entered into the standstill agreement, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, voluntarily.
And so
which
you
is
could have, as Judge Sykes points out, you could have stopped. And I thought you were even now in this court saying that the letter regarding the sick leave was perfectly in compliance with the contract, that it listed all of these grounds why pilots might take sick leave and has the sentence in it saying, of course, don't do it if it's inappropriate. You're defending that right now.
Your Honor, we're defending it, but at the same time, we have agreed not to issue further statements like that. The union has agreed and has stated in court that it will not be doing anything that can be suggested as implying an opportunity for people to take sick leave. Yes, it's all right,
but,
of course.
I guess I'm not sure, and maybe the district judge wasn't sure when you say further statements like that. Okay, you're not going to reissue that letter, but when at one point you're saying, well, this is within the boundaries of legitimate behavior, and then you're saying, and trust us, we'll engage only in legitimate behavior in the future, the district court seems to have thought, well, if that's what you think is acceptable, then maybe we need a stricter rein on things.
The union said that it developed a statement, and it was the same statement as in the standstill agreement. This is what the union will put out. And that statement was very clear. The company agreed to that statement as being a very clear statement that there would be no disruptions, and individually or collectively, there would be no improper use of sick leave. And as far as both parties are concerned, this activity ended. So and the company belief was, and the court's belief was, that the union's statements were effective. That's one of the reasons, unfortunately, she holds the union responsible for what had happened, is that it was successful, in her view, in making it come to an end. It is absolutely appropriate to look forward as well as backward. We're not arguing against that point, Your Honor, but we are saying that under the rules of the Railway Labor Act and the Norris LaGuardia Act, a party is entitled to take voluntary action and to make that stick in order to keep the courts out of it. That's part of the purpose of these laws. The voluntary cessation criticism, those cases that the company has cited, such as W.T. Grant, had to do with mootness. This case, we're not arguing that this case is moot. We are arguing that this injunction should be dissolved.
So do you think under the Railway Labor Act it's ever possible to have a preliminary injunction when the union has voluntarily ceased the problematic actions?
I think that if the voluntary cessation is accompanied by statements and actions which in themselves raise a high risk of imminent repetition, then no, that wouldn't be appropriate.
So,
but if you look at the cases that happen,
though, if there's, I mean, the sword of Damocles is hanging over you, right? You're in litigation, so I guess you don't think there could ever be an injunction once a case has been filed, and the union is, for the time being, staying within the boundaries that the company is comfortable with.
Unless there is exterior evidence, other evidence, that is not what the union is going to do. And in this case, there was not. All the evidence was about the past, and that is the distinction. If you look at all these other cases, mm-hmm. we'll find that these are cases where there's activity or an imminent threat, and neither of those was present in this case going forward. Thank you, Your Honor. I have a few minutes left. Thank you.
Mr. Sherman, good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'd like to begin by addressing Mr. Abrams' statement that an injunction is not necessary and the job action had ended. He said we admitted and conceded a lot of things which we never admitted, we never conceded. In fact, we disputed, and the trial court found in our favor. He says the sick out ended before we filed the lawsuit. If you look at the exhibits 8, 9, and 10 in the trial court, the sick out had not ended. The level of sick leave was still 2.5 times plan as of July 30, the date we filed the lawsuit.
What incentive will a union have in the future to enter into a standstill agreement when the union's ability to implement that agreement successfully with its members will be used against the union during the injunction hearing? In other words, I'm a little concerned about using the success of the standstill agreement as evidence that the union could have stopped the conduct sooner.
Let me address that in two respects. When you say the success of the standstill agreement had no effect on any of the other elements of this multifaceted job action except sick leave. If you look at the exhibits we provided to the trial court, 2 through 5 and 157, they show the other elements of the job action, delays, cancellations, cockpit checks, and the like. They show that as of, if you look at those charts, they have the first 3 weeks of August, so it's 3 weeks after the standstill agreement. Those numbers are continuing to go up. July 30 is clearly marked on those charts, and all of those elements were continuing to go up. So, yes, ALPA dealt with sick leave. No, ALPA didn't deal with any other elements of the job action. The standstill agreement, quite frankly, didn't address those. Secondly, Your Honor, the reason ALPA entered into the standstill agreement was not because it wanted to do good. The reason it entered into that agreement was because it was a condition of what they wanted with the district court, which is to put the preliminary injunction hearing off until the end of August. That's the whole reason for the standstill agreement.
But let me ask you, though.
And that's what they got is delay. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Right. The Norris-LaGuardia Act does require an injunction to be a measure of last resort. I'm not going to quote the statute, but it's not. It changes the general rules for granting preliminary injunctions. And the district court does hold lots of hearings, the fall unfolds, but things do settle down, and the union members, the leaders of the union, make important representations to the court. And I'm not sure why those representations shouldn't be seen as a perfectly adequate substitute for a formal preliminary injunction when the statute requires that a court can't issue an injunction unless this very high standard is met.
Okay. Two reasons. Number one, at the same time that ALPA put out the standstill agreement, that it made these representations to the courts, it simultaneously published a letter in the same MEC update from the chairman of the MEC vigorously attacking the lawsuit, vigorously attacking the company. So the
idea. Why do they have to like the lawsuit? I mean, I can't really understand why that's a.
Well, their contention is essentially we saw the light and we changed our ways and we promised we wouldn't do it anymore. And if you're looking at whether that can be trusted, you have to look at the actions of the union other than the standstill agreement. I mean,
why shouldn't
I think
we look at the actions of the union just to see are they in fact maintaining the status quo in a way that the RLA arguably requires until the litigation is finished? This is obviously a preliminary injunction. It's designed to maintain the status quo, and I don't see why they have to say, "And we love the, you know, and we love the standstill agreement" at the same time.
Well, they may not have to say we love the standstill agreement, but as I said earlier, they weren't maintaining the status quo. All of the other elements of the job action were continuing and increasing up through the date that the hearing began and through the hearing. So the premise that all of this stuff had stopped is just not accurate. United still couldn't find pilots willing to accept junior manning. It was still suffering other sorts of delays. So that all continued. Secondly, there really is a difference between saying we promise to abide by the standstill agreement and having a preliminary injunction in place. The promise to stand by the standstill agreement has no legal effect without the preliminary injunction. The parties have just, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Continue.
The parties in 6 weeks will enter formal Section 6 negotiations that will continue through the rest of the year. That is when you would normally expect ALPA to initiate one of these job actions, which are very, very common.
That's this April date that's coming up.
Yes,
right,
April
now
is coming. It's critical during that period of time that there not be disruptions. And without a preliminary injunction in place, ALPA is free to, without any consequence, launch a job action at the most sensitive time in the negotiations, and all a company could do is go back to court and start this process again.
Would that not be a true case of cutting off your nose to spite your face? I mean, why at this juncture?
Why would they?
Why in this economic time, and why?
Well, Your Honor, some of the things that the union has done and does, to me, are inexplicable. But history tells us that that is what they do. ALPA consistently has used these job actions. Captain Wallach, the current MEC chair, was elected on the platform of using job actions to force the company to give concessions. We provided the court with a transcript of a debate that he entered into, and he very clearly says we need to have the pilots disrupt the company's operations. He uses code words like we have to tell them to fly the contract, and he says the purpose of lawyers is to get you out of jail when you do what you need to do. This is not an individual. This is not somebody that you can really say we believe you. In fact, the district court sat 3 feet from Captain Wallach, heard him testify, had the opportunity to look at his demeanor and to decide, is this somebody that I trust to keep their promises? And she had an opportunity to see that he had made a similar promise back in January of 2008 to the company to, quote, take the customer out of the equation, and had not kept that promise. So the district court is the proper entity to look at all of the evidence and say, is this a promise that I trust or not? And it seems to me that the district court's discretion to make those kind of findings is really important and should be given deference by this court.
Why did United wait so long to bring the action when it was clear, probably as early as 2006, that these job actions were underway? In other words, why should we consider any conduct outside the six-month period given the delay?
Well, there are two separate questions there, Your Honor. Why did United wait, and why should you consider any conduct? Let me take the second one first, because during the six-month period prior to us filing this lawsuit, you had complete continuation of, and in fact, increase of all of the elements of the job action. It was in June, just 6 months or 6 weeks before the lawsuit was filed, that they began this new element, the fatigue campaign, with which the district court found to be a part of the job action.
Well, no, the fatigue campaign she thought was ambiguous because there had been a series of programs designed to
she thought the if actual effect that it had was difficult to tell.
Right.
But she said there's no question of what was intended, and at least some pilots, she quotes one pilot, some pilots interpreted it as a job action.
Those are weak findings.
But let me address the second part of Your Honor's question, which is why United waited. United was doing what the Railway Labor Act requires it to do, which is attempt to resolve disputes consensually in conference with the union. It entered into a series of negotiations. It reached a tentative agreement in 2007 that it hoped would have dealt with the issue. The pilot group rejected that. It went back into negotiations and attempted to resolve this. It was only when it became clear that, first of all, no matter what it did, the union was going to continue under Captain Wallach, and secondly, that the job action got to the point where it was seriously damaging the customer. That's when United went to court. United tried to work it out. It's obligated to do that. It did that. But if you look at the statute of limitations issue, which is, I think, the sort of legal relevance of why the company didn't go to court in 2007, there's a continuation of the conduct. And, in fact, the level of delays and cancellations in August was 150% of the level as of February 1, 2008. So, in other words, the disruption continued during this whole period of
what
time.
What evidence was there in the record that every single blip that happened to United during July or August or any other time in this period was a direct consequence of what the pilots were doing? I mean, there could have been, United's a big company. You know, you have machinists, as we all know. You have lots of people. And so just because United was having problems with its operations in August, how do we know that was the pilot's fault?
Well, there are several sources of evidence, Your Honor. First of all, there is the history. We produced evidence of a summer of 2000 slowdown, which ALPEP, 8 years later, essentially admitted had occurred. And the court could look at the statistical evidence, compare what had happened in 2000, what had happened this year, look at the communications that ALPA put out that were the same, look at what happened, and the court can draw the inference. If they say this, if they say fly the contract and this happens in 2000, and they say fly the contract and this happens in 2008, there's a very strong inference. The what you call blips, but the ups and downs in the data, which you would see on the exhibits, is clearly correlated to statements by ALPIT. It jumps up in August after Captain in April of 2007 after Captain Bather's video. It goes down then in November of 2007 when Captain Wallach comes out. He puts out this Unity handout, and it goes through the roof. It drops down, and then when they pick it up again in 2008, it goes up. So the cause and effect is there. The other source of evidence is Peter McDonald, the chief operating officer's testimony, that he monitors this data and that there was no other change in United's operations that would explain the increase. He testified to that. There was never any evidence put in by ALPA that there was some other factor except for this. They pulled out one letter that said, United has the finest pilots in the world, and this is the most challenging operating environment. And that doesn't show anything, really.
I was kind of interested in the fact that the district court drew an adverse inference from the failure of the individual defendants to testify at the hearing because United could have called them. Was that a proper inference to draw when the defendants were equally available to United to call them to the stand? And I'm going to ask you on that point if you can distinguish the Bryce case at page 39 of the appellant's brief.
Yes, Your Honor. It was a proper inference. The defendants, ALPA has characterized this as if the court went from they didn't testify to I assume that the opposite of what they testified was true. That is not what the court did. Judge Lefkoe did a very thorough job of explaining her reasoning. What she said was there's a series of facts here, a series of events that lead me to the very strong inference that ALPA and the Industrial Relations Committee was coordinating this job action, beginning with the stated purpose of the IRC, which is to coordinate job actions. That creates a strong inference by itself. The timing of the meeting, it was scheduled the day after United announced its large fleet reduction, so there's an inference that they were trying to do something in response to the fleet reduction. They admitted that at the meeting they planned this fatigue campaign, so they were planning job actions at the meeting. There is this inexplicable conflict between the members about who was on the committee. They say it's immaterial whether Mr. Freeman was or wasn't on the committee. Well, what's material is the conflict in the testimony, because it's inexplicable that a committee with three or four people couldn't agree who was on it. That suggests the cover story. That suggests that maybe everything is inaccurate. The court then looked at what happened afterwards. First of all, the three sort of longtime members of the Industrial Relations Committee had the ability and ultimately did use their communications mechanism to stop the sick out after the lawsuit was filed. They didn't do that before. Mr. Freeman, on the other hand, put out a communication to all of what they call the 2172 members, the junior pilots, on June 18, a week later, that said, the MEC is going to do things. Watch out. Stuff is coming. Same communication says certain posts were taken down from the website, and he says certain posts weren't singled out. Certain subjects were, though, and he's talking about sick leave. Quote, some things just aren't meant for paper or electronic communications. That doesn't mean don't engage in a sick out. That means don't put it in writing. There are similar posts by Mr. Freeman up through July 11, and then on July 11, he posts a document which was actually quoted at some length by the court at A59 of the appendix, where he says, essentially in excused language, I'm glad we're all pissed off if you think one motherfucking minute that nothing is being done, so fucking be it. You want to pour a shitload of energy on the line before we get the rudder where we want it, and without enough other folks, we need to help paddle.
Was he ever a governor?
Do you understand what I'm getting at? Pardon? Your Honor, amidst the laughter, I missed the question. I apologize.
Was he ever the governor of Illinois?
No. But then the court looked at what happened afterwards, which is you have, in fact, a sick out. No, it wasn't on July 4, but it was 2 weeks later. The court looked at the participation of the 2172 members in that sick out. Two-thirds of them, including Mr. Freeman, called in sick. That's sort of compelling evidence as to what was up. And then the very last thing that the court considered was the failure to testify at trial. And what the court said was, I have a compelling case. United, in its pre-hearing briefing, has raised substantial questions. We actually had a list of questions for the IRC members, unanswered questions and conflicts. They've raised all of these questions. It is, within the dynamic courtroom, it was clear that they had to testify. They had to rebut that inference. And the court said, when they didn't testify, when they didn't, sit 3 feet away from me, look me in the eye, testify under oath and subject to cross-examination, I can only make one conclusion, that all of the circumstantial evidence shows what happened because they didn't take the witness stand under oath, look me in the eye, and give me some other explanation. That is far different than saying I'm inferring the opposite of what they testify. That is what district judges do every day. They take a whole body of evidence. It's like all of these little pixels on the screen, and they look at it, and it paints a picture. And you can't pull out one pixel and argue whether it's green or blue when the whole screen paints a very clear picture as to what was happening here, Your Honor. Let me just close with a couple of other comments. One on this question of continuing conduct. If you look at the IAM decision, contrary to what ALPA says in its brief, in the IAM case, which I was involved in, the level of disruption went up immediately after Judge Hibbler issued the TRO. Then when we filed a contempt motion in the district court, it dropped pretty substantially. And when the district judge finally addressed the question of whether to issue a preliminary injunction, it had actually dropped pretty substantially. District court denied that, and this court, really 2 months later, said that was error. So you have, I mean, the distinction isn't there. You can't have the same pattern. Yes, once you go into court, there's a reduction. But this court said, under those circumstances, it was error not to issue the preliminary injunction.
And before you sit down, could you tie all of this back to the standards under the Railway Labor Act? Because it seems to me that is the core of Mr. Abrams' argument.
Absolutely.
In a word, since I know your time is up, but if you would indulge me.
Absolutely, Your Honor, with the court's permission. Section 2(1) of the Railway Labor Act says a union, well, it says employees, and has been interpreted to mean the union, must exert every reasonable effort to resolve any dispute without interruption to commerce or the carrier's operations. The courts have consistently said that that obligates the union not simply to avoid a strike, but to refrain from any sort of slowdown, sick out, or other disruption of the carrier's operations, and that the courts can enjoin that conduct. This court, in the IAM case, and let me also recommend the 11th Circuit's decision in the Delta case, said that that is an overwhelming obligation, that if there is a job action occurring, the union has an affirmative legal obligation to stop it. And if there is a job action occurring, the district court can issue a preliminary injunction. And that an injunction is essentially the, quote, only practical effective method of dealing with the violation of Section 2(1). That's the only remedy there is. The majority of courts have held there's no damage remedy, so it's an injunction or nothing. That's the legal basis. It is abundantly clear. Judge Lefko, a very good judge, she issued an 85-page opinion, thoroughly citing the record, explaining her reasoning. And, Your Honor, we submit that there is no basis for reversal of that excellent, well-reasoned decision. Thank you. Unless the court has further questions.
Thank you, Mr. German. Would you please add 2 minutes to Mr. Abrams' time?
Thank you, Your Honor. Hope I won't be needing all of it, but I'll just very briefly hit a few points, if I may, Your Honors. First, the company presented no evidence of operational disruptions after this point in August that counsel has just referred to. And when the hearing started, we pointed out that on September 4th, the company had said publicly that they had a strong finish to their operation in the summer, in August, and this was both the CEO and the chief operating officer, and this is Defendant's Exhibit 76. So we put them on notice that they needed to come forward with evidence of an ongoing disruption, ongoing job action, whether it's junior, senior manning, sick leave, or any of the operating statistics, and they did not do so because they knew that they had their summer had finished fine at that point. Secondly, I want to talk about the credibility issue that Your Honors have raised with respect to the individual defendants, and Mr. German spoke about. He quoted somewhat flamboyantly from one statement by one of the defendants out of
dozens upon dozens of statements that are in the record that showed the efforts of those individual defendants to prevent a sick out, because it was their view as union representatives that a sick out would be, as they put it, counter-strategic. Aside from being unlawful, it would be counter-strategic. It would give the company the very leverage that they developed, that is the ability to go into court and get an injunction and have leverage over the union, which is what an injunction does in a labor dispute. So there was lots of statements by them saying that they were against it and showing that they were against it and trying to get pilots not to engage in it. And so the company has chosen out of context some statements, usually the ones with the rougher language in them, in order to paint the union in the colors of not having complied. If you go back to that June 11th meeting, the increase in sick leave had started before that meeting took place. And it started because, for the reasons that the company understood, that pilots who were going to be furloughed were burning through their sick leave, not as a concerted job action. And this was true of the members of the 2172 website in July as well. They were burning through their sick leave because they were going to be furloughed and couldn't take it with them. They wanted to have time off with their families. They wanted to have time to look for other jobs. The company expected that to happen, and they didn't say anything to the union about the sick leave usage until July 16th, some 6 weeks after the increase in sick leave started, because they knew that it was going to happen. So you have this June 11th meeting. What did the pilots say to each other in that meeting about the sick leave? The company took a statement by Captain Tamkin, one of their pilots, who was the chairman of the Industrial Relations Committee, and it says that statement shows he was just trying to wash his hands of the sick out, of a sick out, not that he was trying to stop it. And how they do that? This is
contested what he actually said, right?
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Aren't there two versions of what Captain Tamkin said?
There is what he said had two sentences in it. And on page 34 of their brief, they quoted the first sentence and left out the second sentence. And this is while they're challenging his credibility. The other defendants all testify that Captain Tamkin had said, and that they had said to each other, that we should not let this happen. This is not a good idea, and we should take steps to try to prevent it from happening, which they did. The other little discrepancies that they talk about, well, was Mr. Freeman, when did he become a member? Three of them said that they knew he was a member, and Captain Tapkin knew he was a member, but it's not just a four-person committee. It's a large network of pilots who talk to each other, and that's what this committee is. And Mr. Freeman was initially a coordinator out of Denver under Captain Tamkin's jurisdiction in his region. So when the company says, well, we put forward these conflicts and tried in order to provoke the defendants into testifying, which is really what they wanted to do after they had taken their depositions, and try to get more testimony out of them, they could have put those individuals on the stand, and they did not do so. So we do think that Bryce, and we do think that this court's real reluctance to sanction or to permit the use of an adverse inference because of non-testimony, particularly when the individuals were available, that is all consistent with what we're saying, and that is the court should not have drawn that inference. It should not have made findings against those individuals.
But even if you're right about that, listening to Mr. German, he didn't quite put it this way, but why, even if it was a mistake to put that at the end, wouldn't that be harmless?
It wouldn't be harmless because I think, my view, if you look at the decision as a whole, I think one of the linchpins for the court's reasoning was her decision, her view, that the union had instigated this alleged sick out. And
but
I think
was it a linchpin where she's, I mean, I'm just talking about the failure to testify comment,
right,
when all the rest of the evidence is in there. Even if she shouldn't have thrown that into the mix, why does it matter?
Well, we can't know for sure, of course, Your Honor, which one of these factors was the one that tipped her over into making these determinations against the defendants. You know, was it A, B, C, or D? We don't know. And she relied on all of those factors, and you can't tell which one was determinative.
I see the light is on, and I thank Your Honors.
You have another minute.
I do. All right. Well, I just want to hit one thing then, Your Honors, and that is the statute of limitations. And I want to be a little clear about this because I think both briefs have been a little unclear, both sides' briefs. This is a status quo case. An alleged slowdown, an alleged job action has to do with a violation of the status quo. The Atlas Air case, which the company relies on, while part of it was a two-first case, that part was dismissed on summary judgment because of the District of Columbia's decision that Atlas Air had no status quo obligation where there was no existing agreement. That case was decided ultimately under Sections 2/3 and 2/4, which is not the status quo issue, and it relied upon an NLRB doctrine that says that maintaining a discriminatory employment plan, such as the profit-sharing plan in that case, is an ongoing violation, that you don't have to simply go back. The 6 months is always renewed by that and is told by that being maintained. This is a status quo case, and in this case, the company alleges that the union violated the status quo and did so with the alleged Fix It Now campaign, which it started in December of 2006, 19 months before the lawsuit was filed. So, and the only two status quo cases that either side has cited are cases that apply the 6 month statute of limitations. So the two cases under the Railway Labor Act that do that. So, when you look at this as a status quo case, you realize that at most the company would be able to complain about activity within the last 6 months, but that activity was essentially consistent with what was going on just before that 6 months, so there's really no basis for complaining about that with respect to the slowdown, alleged slowdown. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, thanks to you, Mr. Abram, and Mr. German, and the case will be taken under advisement.